From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We are rarely more vulnerable than when we're sick. That's why new evidence that doctors sometimes take advantage of their patients shakes the trust required in a patient-doctor relationship. That new research is the result of a year-long national investigation by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Doctors are figures of respect and trust in our society, but a startling new report this morning reveals more than 2,000 American doctors have been implicated in the sexual abuse of their own patients, including some of the most prestigious physicians in the country.
We'll talk with some of the AJC's reporting team in a moment. First, though, let's talk about a safer kind of crime, the kind that's found in novels. We heard from author Karen Slaughter yesterday. Her latest book is a thriller called Pretty Girls, set here in Atlanta. I recommend it for a read. It's a good one. And we wanted to know who some of your favorite crime writers are. So here are your first thoughts.
My name is David Perper in Augusta, Georgia. I was calling about crime writers, favorite crime writers. It's Elmore Leonard. No doubt.
So let's get a taste of David's recommendation. Here's some of Elmore Leonard's novel, Killshot.
When the phone rang, he'd been trying to figure out why he drank so much. He was thinking now as he began to picture a young girl in the hotel room in Detroit. He drank because he needed to drink. When the girl opened the door, she didn't seem scared at all. She was about 18, maybe, wearing a robe, with long blonde hair down over her shoulders like a little girl. Except her expression wasn't a little girl's.
I've read that book. It's great. We always love to get your recommendations and your thoughts. You can call us and leave a message like David did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OSD Talk or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. It all started in a prison, actually. Investigative reporter Danny Robbins looked into reports of mistreatment of patients by doctors in local correctional facilities, and that reporting appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
We've written about 9 deaths that we can document of women at Pulaski State Prison and Emanuel Women's Facility. What we're looking at are life and death situations, potentially fatal illnesses being downplayed or ignored.
But Danny didn't end in just looking at doctors in prisons. What he eventually uncovered were unspeakable crimes by physicians that were more widespread than he or his editor could have imagined. The full story was revealed this week in a nationwide investigation that documented widespread sexual abuse carried out by doctors. That investigation cited thousands of reported abuse cases across the country, and many of these criminal acts went largely unpunished, and most of the abusive physicians were allowed to continue seeing patients. In the end, the AJC needed a team of journalists to put the full picture together, and 2 members of that team join us now. Carrie Teagarden is a reporter for the investigations team. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Celeste.
And Jeff Ernsthausen is a reporter and data specialist. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
There was a lot of data to sift.
Yes.
Yes. But one of the things that strikes me as I read through this piece, and I had to read through it 2 or 3 times, as disturbing as it was, to get my mind around what you were saying, was the fact that a lot of data was actually not available. How did you get some of this data? Because it appears as though a lot of the things that occurred when someone was accused, when it went through a medical board, much of that was secret.
Yeah, a lot of it is secret. So we started out by asking medical boards across the country for this data, thinking that they would have something like this, that they would have,
they'd have
categorizations
to have a record.
And these kinds of records, yes. And the majority of them were getting back to us saying that they didn't have what we were looking for. They didn't have these offenses classified in any way that we could analyze as data. So we ended up deciding to kind of take that into our own hands. And what we did is we built what are called scrapers, little bots that would go to their websites and essentially search them systematically and download the information that was on them, including these PDFs that were documenting what physicians had done. And we ended up analyzing those to compile our information.
What did you find? Were you surprised by how many scrapings you got?
Yeah, in the end, we ended up with over 100,000 records from the process, and which is an enormous amount to sift through.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah, and so we had to kind of figure out a way to target that, and so we ended up creating a program that would essentially assign a probability that we would find sexual allegations in the documents for any given doctor. And then limited our kind of further search to those doctors.
Okay, so Carrie, A couple people have mentioned in their reporting that you guys found thousands of doctors who've been accused. In those particular cases, how often were doctors accused and then admitted to culpability or found to be at fault by any kind of organizing board, whether it be in law enforcement or a medical board?
Well, in the cases that we were able to see, those were cases where there was a finding.
Right.
Otherwise, there would not have been a
public order. Otherwise, you wouldn't even have been able to find it.
Exactly.
You can't find accusations that were made, even if they were made by multiple patients against the same doctor, unless they were found culpable.
That's correct. In fact, in some cases where there was eventually a disciplinary action, you would see this long trail that had not been made public. So the cases that we're able to look at are cases where there had been a finding.
So that brings us to Dr. Jacob Ward, who is still practicing in Atlanta?
That's correct.
Okay, so he eventually pleaded guilty to molesting a patient, correct?
Correct.
And when that occurred, it sounds like exactly what you're talking about. Then they found out that two other patients had made similar charges.
And that in that case, that was handled privately by the medical board with a private letter to him. So if you were the next patient coming in, you would have no idea that that had taken place. And we found that in numerous states, that's done. Not all states allow it, but many do. And in North Carolina,
where they just send them a letter that we don't know what it says, but it probably says stop doing that.
It's generally, it's called a private letter of concern. In some cases are private agreements that require a doctor to perhaps always have a chaperone in the room or go take lie detector tests from experts who monitor physicians. But those are things that might be required. And again, as a patient, you would never know. The kind of secrecy around a lot of these cases was a big finding for us that reminded us in some way of how the Catholic priest scandal unfolded as well, where cases were handled very in secret, private. But in this case, these are state medical boards, you know, that are making a decision that will handle some cases privately. They've told us that in some cases, that's because they feel they don't have the evidence to really make a public disciplinary action.
But
they
are not required to turn it over to the police?
Well, that's another thing we spent a long time researching. In most states, medical boards aren't required legally to turn cases over to police, even if it's potentially a crime. Some say they do, but only in about 11 states are they actually required by law to do so.
How widely does the treatment of these kind of cases vary from state to state?
I think we saw a fair amount of variance, mm-hmm. You know, just going through them. I think you would see in some states you could, and it varied a little bit with what we could see based on what they made available to us. But I think you would find some states where you would almost always see it end with a physician losing their license. In other states, you wouldn't see that. And in some states, you'd see the same physician being able to practice in that state where they had lost their ability to practice in several other states.
There's one doctor in particular that you guys mentioned in Austin, Texas, who's been accused 17 times by 17 different patients of sexual misconduct. Still practicing?
That's correct, yes. And that was a case where the police got involved, and the first case that went forward, there was only one victim that the jury knew about. And so when that case ended with an acquittal...
Know of one victim because the medical board keeps the others secret.
Well, the medical board heard from all the others, but for whatever reason and how the case was handled, just one person testified. And then after that case didn't go well, then the medical board sort of compromised. And so that's...
And it didn't go well because it was, he said, there was no physical evidence of misconduct. And so it was basically, do we believe this doctor or do we believe this patient? Is that accurate?
And the defense really attacked the credibility of the patient. And we've seen that. One thing we've seen over and over again is a lot of the patients who are abused tend to be vulnerable patients, people who maybe even have a history of being abused in the past, people who are there because it's a workers' comp doctor and they really can't change doctors. We had a case where a doctor had told a patient, well, I know you're on Social Security disability, and if you raise any questions about me, I will do what I can to have your Social Security taken away. Doctors who were employment screening physicians. So in a physician-patient relationship, there's always an imbalance of power, but we found that in some cases that imbalance was pronounced by the vulnerability of the patients involved.
Some of this, Jeff, comes down to consent, I saw, but what is the law and what are the restrictions in terms of consensual sex? Is it ever okay for a doctor to have consensual sex with a patient that they're treating?
Not according to the medical community, and in many, many states, it's illegal for them to do so. Well, especially in the case of psychiatrists, for instance. So there are some relationships that are very much, it is an illegal act to engage in any kind of sexual behavior with a patient.
Whether it's consensual. Because I noticed that many of the doctors that responded, either to you or to the medical board, had said, I thought it was consensual. But that's still a problem in most places, is it not?
Yeah, and it raises some questions as well. I mean, these documents don't tell us everything. And one does have to wonder how it came to the attention of the medical board in those instances.
So, Carrie, one of the things that interested me was because you went to the many medical boards and asked them, why have you returned all these people to practice? You write that in Georgia and Kansas, for example, two of every three doctors that have been publicly disciplined for sexual misconduct were allowed to return to practice. And one of the things that surprised me is that they say they have to consider whether or not there are enough physicians, mm-hmm. and how much money has been spent to educate these doctors. That is shocking to me. Why?
Right. We in the story described it as physicians are sort of like the big banks. They're considered too big to fail. A lot of the medical boards were very open with us about the need for doctors. And I think, you know, doctors generally make up the majority of medical boards. And taking away somebody's license is to them a really, really drastic move. And so I think they've generally across the country, you see that there's a system that most rely on, which is when they find that a doctor has offended, they generally send them in for some kind of evaluation and treatment. There's an industry that's sprung up that evaluates and treats physicians. And then they return them to practice under conditions that they say are very good and reliable at keeping patients safe. And that's sort of the system. I think the irony for us when we started hearing about this was, well, what if we were talking about a teacher? You know, what if we were talking about a coach? What if we were today talking about a priest? How would that feel? You know, would that feel
if they
like
went
the
in
right
for
way.
Therapy and they signed a letter saying they wouldn't do it again?
Mm-hmm. No, and we've seen, you know, cases over and over again, teachers generally get arrested.
Yeah,
and it's in law that it's that even if the student involved is 18, consent is not a defense.
My guests are two Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporters who've spent a year on a nationwide investigation into doctors and sexual abuse of patients. That investigation continues, so the AJC is asking you to share your experiences, if you have them. To contact the reporting team, you can email doctors@ajc.com. Carrie Teagarden and Jeff Ernsthausen and their co-reporters found what they call a phenomenon of physician sexual misconduct that is tolerated in every state in the nation. And Carrie, this is the thing. You guys have uncovered thousands of doctors who have admitted culpability or been found culpable, but we don't know actually how large the problem is at this point.
That's correct. And nobody really knows. And I think that's one thing that we feel should be on the public policy agenda, that there should be better tracking, better awareness, and more transparency around this so that at the very least, patients can be aware if their own doctor has been disciplined or a doctor that they're considering going to has had an issue.
Yeah, I mean, before I send my daughter to a doctor, that's horrifying. So, Jeff, what questions do you still need to get answered? What has not been settled for you?
I think we still want to, and we have work left to scrutinize various parts of the system that go into what we find out and what we don't find out and what does happen to doctors and what doesn't happen to doctors.
Do you mean the processes once somebody makes a complaint? Is that what you're talking about? What happens then?
From point A to the end of the process, I think we will be taking a close look at the various actors that would come into that system.
And again, there's no national standard for that, right? It varies from state to state?
That's correct.
According to Medical Board, Jeff Ernsthausen and Carrie Teagarden are part of the reporting team that uncovered new data on doctors and sex abuse of patients for the AJC. We have a link to their story at our Facebook page. Jeff and Carrie, I assume I'll be talking to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Now, another medical story. One in four adults in the U.S. deals with a mental health disorder every year. And the National Alliance on Mental Health reports that more than half of them did not receive treatment within the past year. Telepsychiatry hopes to bridge that gap. It connects patients with psychiatrists directly using phone and video calls. Dale Peoples is an associate professor of child adolescent psychiatry at the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University, and he joins us now to talk about how this virtual treatment works. Good morning, Dale.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to hear your voice. I mean, we're talking basically about Skype, right, where you see people over videos, that type of technology?
More or less, that's it. We tend to use systems developed specifically for telemedicine to ensure patient privacy, as opposed to some of the more general, Skype
consumer
type programs. Yeah,
and there are other things that are available with the programs that you use. For example, you can zoom in very closely using the technology you have, right?
Right. And a lot of the programs are actually inclusive of all fields of medicine. So some of them have attachments where, a doctor, with the assistance of a staff on the other end can listen to a heartbeat, take a look in the ear. So some of the equipment's pretty high tech, you know.
So the purpose of this, I mean, we've had the technology in broad strokes for quite some time, but I assume that one of the reasons it's being deployed more is because there are places in Georgia and around the nation where patients don't have access to see a psychiatrist in their office. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was around 2006, I want to say, that the Georgia legislature recognized this as a major deficit, that many Georgians didn't have access to specialty services, psychiatry included.
Sorry to interrupt you, but many? How many? Are we talking about thousands? Hundreds?
Oh, hundreds of thousands? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Essentially the push from the legislator's point of view was that, hey, we want to get everyone within at least an hour's drive of a specialist, which still can be a challenge, an hour for many families. That's really when kind of the ball got rolling statewide, I'd say. And it's gradually built steam, and they've tried to increase the number of locations. The idea is really to reach individuals closer to home.
I mean, it's fairly clear what the benefits are of this type of technology, to be able to see your doctor just from your own living room. The immediacy, I'm sure it's cheaper. But what are the downsides? Are there things that you can detect and see when you have someone in your office as opposed to when they're on a computer screen?
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Even though I'm a strong supporter of telemedicine, I'd say it does have limitations to actually being there physically with someone in the office. Depending on the equipment you're using, you might not be able to read those subtle facial cues quite as well as if you're directly in front of the person. You've got a limited view with the camera. So I work with kids a lot, and kids with ADHD sometimes are whipping around the office and sit in front of the camera for me can be a challenge. I've done work with nursing homes in the past, and some folks who aren't native to this technology, didn't grow up with it, it can be a little bit of a challenge for them to use.
And what difference does it make I mean, there has to be some kind of reaction in your brain, emotional or neurological, mm-hmm. to dealing with a computer screen as opposed to dealing with a living, breathing, warm human being.
Yeah. One of the biggest things I've noticed is, you know, really the eye contact, because, you know, the individual's looking at you on the screen and your camera placement's usually right above the screen. So, you know, your gaze is never quite meet up.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And it does, that to me is the biggest artificial barrier with it, that, you know, we're just not quite looking at each other.
And yet, I assume, because you are such a supporter of this type of technology, that just being able to see a patient, period, as opposed to the number of people that were going without treatment entirely, that outweighs these cons we're talking about, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you know, there's been a number of studies looking at patient satisfaction, and generally you see that patients are just as satisfied with telemedicine as they are with in-office visits. Now, a lot of that has to do with the add-on convenience factor for them, that, you know, they didn't spend 4 hours in the car getting to you.
Does it matter for you what kind of limitations would you want to set on it? Would you want to always have a nurse available who can take vital signs and blood pressure and things like that?
I do feel like, you know, from the doctor's point of view, that's definitely best practice. You know, if, you know, it's just purely outside of a medical setting on the patient's end, one, you know, they might call me up when they're on vacation and Florida, and I'm licensed to practice in Florida, so I'm, you know, kind of skirting the law there if that happens.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And then, you know, also just kind of the, you know, safety and security issues. You know, the medications I prescribe can affect blood pressure, can affect heart rate. You know, I like to have the confidence that information's being gathered by a professional on the other end, too.
It's really interesting. Dale Peoples is an associate professor of child adolescent psychiatry at the Medical College at Augusta University. Dale, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. The film Swiss Army Man tells the story of a shipwrecked man, played by Paul Dano, who befriends a corpse. That corpse is played by Daniel Radcliffe. The film is in select theaters in Atlanta right now, and there's local flavor in the film. The soundtrack was composed by Andy Hull and Robert McDowell. They're part of the Atlanta indie rock band Manchester Orchestra, and they stopped by our studios recently to add their picks to our ever-growing Essential Georgia playlist. We ask people to choose two songs they think best represent Georgia, and here are the rules. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians can't nominate one of their own songs. So, let's turn it over to Manchester Orchestra for the latest installment of our Georgia playlist.
Got some bad news this morning. My name is Andy Hull. I am a musician from Atlanta, Georgia. I play in the band Manchester Orchestra, and I recently co-scored the movie Swiss Army Man.
And I am Robert McDowell. I am also from Georgia and in Manchester Orchestra, and had the opportunity to score and compose Swiss Army Man with Andy.
Who's gonna save my soul?
The first song for the Georgia playlist that I chose, which is a very difficult thing to do because there's so many, but this one recently has been on my mind, is from Gnarls Barkley, the song Who's Gonna Save My Soul. I think the coolest thing about Gnarls Barkley and CeeLo's career was that it kind of opened up to this really dark way of talking about things. Not that he hadn't done that before, but it sort of had this soulful darkness to it.
He was imitated often. Felt like I was being myself.
First time I heard this song, it went right through me, and I'm pretty sure the music video of this song is where CeeLo's heart escapes out of his chest and starts singing, "Who's gonna save my soul now?" So yeah, that would be my first selection.
Pretty sure I know the song you're speaking of, but sing a little bit for me, Andy.
Who's gonna save my soul now?
Mm-hmm. That's the one. I wonder if I live to grow old now. Getting high cause I feel so low now. And maybe it's a little selfish. All I have is the memory. It sounds like a guy that's dying. Got some bad news this morning, which in turn made my day. When this someone spoke, I listened. All of a sudden, has less to say. Oh, how could this be? All this time I lived vicariously. Who's going to save my soul now? So, you know, it's sort of not exactly what you would expect. That was what I loved about Gnarls Barkley, was that other side of CeeLo on top of this production. The production on this song is really, really cool, too. It's really super soulful. So the song that I'm going to pick, when I told Andy, he actually somewhat debated it, but I consider him an Athens, Georgia artist, and it is Holland 1945 by Nutramilk Hotel. That record came out when I was much younger, and I heard it, and I remember having an emotional reaction to the music and to the lyrics and certain songs on it, trying to digest it. And it was a song that I'm split between that emotion of the first time I heard it, thinking that I was the only one, and then brought to that moment where it was, you know, 20 of us playing it on stage poorly, very sloppily, but it was a fun thing. So it went from an isolated feeling all the way to this community behind the song. Might have a better insight into this, Andy, because yeah. It's a bizarro song.
It's essentially, the whole record is loosely about Anne Frank. It's a story. It says it's about a guy being in love with a girl who was killed during the Holocaust.
Yeah,
that is what it's about.
Yeah.
The big part in that song is then here's where your mother sleeps. Here's the room where your brothers were born. Indentions in the sheets. Where bodies once moved, but don't move anymore. It's so sad to see the world agree that they would rather see her face filled with flies. Oh, and I want to see white roses in her eyes. I mean, the song sonically sounds like Pandemonium. It's like the drums are like super squashed and crazy. And I remember the first time I heard that song going like, wow, I didn't know you were allowed to make records that sounded like this. Because it doesn't necessarily sound good to like an audio
file. It's perfect
and
it's like imperfection.
Exactly.
That was Andy Hull and Robert McDowell of Manchester Orchestra. Their latest work can be heard on the soundtrack for the film Swiss Army Man. It's showing now at select theaters, including Atlanta's Midtown Art Cinema. What songs would you add to the Georgia playlist? You can call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. The United States had just begun to recover from World War II in 1946. Soldiers returned home to a very different kind of battle on American soil.
Public enemy number one. Anopheles, the malaria mosquito. Wanted, for bringing sickness and misery to untold millions in many parts of the world.
A devious enemy requires specialized soldiers. And so, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were created in Atlanta to fight malaria and other deadly illnesses around the world. The agency celebrates its 70th birthday this month and will be at the party with a live broadcast from inside the CDC tomorrow. We'll take a look back at the CDC's incredible history in just a moment. But first, let's talk about its future. Last month, high schoolers from all over the country spent about a week at the CDC learning from public health experts who tackle Ebola, HIV, and that continuing threat, malaria.
You know, the biggest burden is in Democratic Republic of Congo and Nigeria. And if we could really control and wipe out malaria there, we would wipe out over 50% of malaria in the world.
Gail Steniez is an epidemiologist for the CDC based in Zimbabwe, but students got to meet and ask her questions on a recent day at the CDC.
Well, this might sound a little dumb because I don't know much about malaria, but is there like a vaccine or anything?
There is a vaccine. It's not as effective with the amount of coverage, you know, 90% coverage, say, of a measles vaccine.
17-year-old Forrest Streeter of Boise, Idaho, says he plans to go into public health, and he says he'd love to end up at the CDC.
I guess I really like the idea of going out of the country and helping people that don't really, you know, have that kind of ability to help themselves with certain diseases like polio and malaria.
CDC disease detective Amy Bohr does just that. She helps handle diseases like smallpox and Ebola, and here she shares her experience with two young girls.
Any kind of disease you're talking about, you're usually talking about very sensitive and vulnerable people who are very afraid and maybe not all that trusting of whatever you're trying to do.
Bohr says some of the biggest cultural hurdles she's faced have been here in the United States.
The Navajo Reservation, for instance, we went to families where I was told I couldn't ask them a direct question because it wasn't culturally sensitive, but I had to do an interview. So I'm like, I don't know how do you not directly ask if they ate tomatoes? And in New Mexico, we hit houses that had signs out that said, if you come on my property, we'll shoot you. And so then we're like, what do we do here? So
a career in public health may seem daunting after hearing that, but not for 16-year-old Jasmine Cruz of Atlanta. After spending some time at the CDC camp, she has a pretty good idea about what disease she wants to fight.
I'd probably choose Zika, because there's always been a lot of illnesses transmitted through mosquitoes, and Zika's been affecting babies and children, and it really is really interesting to me.
Another teen whose eyes have been opened to a career in public health is 18-year-old Farhana Rahman of Atlanta. She wants to study HIV and Ebola, but there's something else that resonates with her as well.
When I was little, I was telling my mom, oh, I don't need vaccines. They're going to stab the injection on my arm, so I don't want to do that. So I hate the injection. She was like, no, you need it. You need that for your healthy life in future. So that right now I'm realizing, oh, vaccines are pretty important.
CDC Museum Director Judy Gant is delighted by all the activity today at the summer camp, and she knows it pays off.
They walk from person to person and ask questions about how they got to do what they do, where they've been, what their work is. Because our camp started in 2004, there are actually campers who work here now.
The camp is perhaps raising a new generation of disease fighters to join the CDC's storied history. Mary Hilpertshauser literally walked me through that history at the CDC Museum in Atlanta. She's the historic collections manager at the museum.
So we're looking at a picture of the very first headquarters for the CDC.
Mm-hmm. Headquarters building, in downtown Atlanta. Well, actually, we just took over the MCWA headquarters building. MCWA was a program, once again, in the public health service. It was all about malaria control in war areas, making sure that our servicemen were safe and healthy before they were deployed. And most of our training and most of the war effort was in the southeast. So that's where it was all headquartered. And in Atlanta, that's where the MCWA headquarters were.
In order to
so that they got rid of
the soldiers before
exactly.
They shipped out.
So they got rid of malaria in the southeast because during the 40s, malaria was endemic to that region. So they got rid of it, and they got rid of a few other things while they were at it. They got rid of typhus and yellow fever. So because of that, after the war ended, the Public Health Service thought it would be great to keep this group together and have them work on other communicable diseases. So in 1946, July 1st, the Communicable Disease Center was born.
And this was the headquarters, it says circa 1950. Mm-hmm. It's not very large. The building we're looking at, they're on
really,
top of...
Really, we were only part of the, first three floors. Not the first three floors, but the upper three floors.
Yeah, and it's on top of a diner, mm-hmm.
It's not very big, yeah. yeah.
And since then, it's grown... I mean, do we have an idea of the size of the campus, the full campus of the CDC at this point?
There are many campuses to CDC. Then they're not just in Atlanta. So there's about 16,000 employees right now, full-time employees, but then that doesn't include contractors and other people that are added on as needed.
I notice a picture of longtime Coca-Cola Company president Robert Woodruff on the wall, and I had to know why it was there.
At the time, we're looking at around 1947. This is 1 year after CDC was born. We were in 49 different sites around Atlanta, and we wanted one place to really call home. So Emory, at the behest of Robert Woodruff, because he was on the board of Emory, who they gifted about 15 acres of land to the federal government so that you could establish CDC here on Clifton Road. And because we couldn't just get a gift, we had to give a token payment. So that token payment was $10. And according to local legend and lore of CDC, each employee either contributed a penny or a dollar. It just depends. But they came up with $10.
They searched their
yeah,
pockets.
Their, found it in their change purse or something. Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on. CDC is founded.
Mm-hmm. In the early 50s, the Epidemic Intelligence Service was started because it was part of a federal plan to develop an early warning system towards outbreaks or biowarfare. So they were concerned with biowarfare in the 50s.
And so that brings us to polio, which was obviously a huge problem in the 1940s and 50s.
It was. But in 1955, the Salk vaccine was...
Jonas Salk, mm-hmm. who gifted his vaccine to the world.
So there was this whole program to vaccinate all the children in the United States. So this program was started up, but they found that on the West Coast, there were a lot of kids that were coming down with polio after they received a vaccine. So they temporarily halted that program, sent out the EIS officers to see if they could figure out what was causing this, why are the kids coming down with it, and they did. They were able to find out, they traced that the vaccines that were given to these children were, laboratory was called the Cutter Laboratories. There were other manufacturers, but Cutter was the one that really took the blame for all of that.
They were making faulty vaccines.
They were making a vaccine that hadn't gone through the right process. So they found that out, stopped that vaccine from getting out, probably put Cutter at ease and showed them how to make the vaccine, and then started the program back up. And so that many, many lives were saved.
So here, you have a...
And then also put the disease detectors on the map. Making Congress look at us and go, ooh, yeah, that was a good idea. And we're so glad that the Communicable Disease Center is on the ball solving those outbreaks.
Which opened up the funding.
And they brought in more programs. And that's how CDC grows. It grows by acquisition and how Congress assigns us things, or the Public Health Service assigned us new programs. And in 1957, they assigned us the Venereal Disease Control Group, which was great because it came with a lot of money, a lot of personnel, and it brought with it this new program called the Public Health Advisors, which were these great group of field workers that would go in and do, they tracked down the infected people, went door to door, finding out who's infected, and they did the first thing that we called contact tracing. Now,
they were trying to find patient zero.
Well, they weren't finding patient zero. They were just trying to inform people that you may or may have not have been exposed to syphilis or gonorrhea.
And sending them for testing. But, all of this that we're looking at, especially as we get into immunizations and as we start to talk about what happened with syphilis at the Tuskegee Institute, a lot of CDC's ability to function requires a good relationship with the public and an establishment of trust. Has that been there since the founding of CDC?
I believe so, because mainly we work for the state and health departments, local health departments and state health departments. That's really who we support. And I don't think CDC was really known at all. We were behind the scenes a lot. And the only way we really communicated was through journal articles or things like that, people didn't know that we really existed. We weren't CDC brand yet.
When do you think the CDC brand became known? Because certainly we see the CDC all the time, anytime
right.
you see a movie or a TV show about a virus wiping out the human race.
Historically, we really didn't communicate to the outside world until the mid-70s, when we really started to communicate directly to the media. We were actually in the midst of solving another outbreak, Legionnaires' disease, when we had to do this big press conference, which is something new to us. We didn't even have the facilities.
So would you see that as sort of a sea change at the CDC, that moment when they had to learn, when a whole huge group of scientists had to learn how to talk to the public?
Yeah, there was a few people that were a little more reticent to that. I think that we learned to do that. And once again, it's part of our history, so you learn from our past and you improve on it. Like the program that started in VD, we've improved on it. Our lessons learned from Tuskegee and the whole part
of that. Injecting black men with syphilis purposely.
Well, that was something that we inherited from the Public Health Service when they gave us the venereal disease control group.
They
that
also
program,
gave you the Tuskegee program.
The Tuskegee program. And
that's
that
a
wasn't
nice gift.
Really discovered until we were like 5 years into it and going, oh, wow, what's this program? And
look at this awful thing.
What is this? And it was a very horrible thing, but it was also a great lesson in ethics, too.
It looks as though we're about to move into where the CDC moves outside American borders and into the rest of the world.
Right, the smallpox program.
So let's talk about how that happened.
This was actually a program that was piggybacked on the back of a global measles program. And so they thought, well, while we're at it, why don't we start to immunize for smallpox? And it just was like a perfect storm at the time, and we were able to get into these countries and do mass vaccinations in West and Central Africa. And then we moved over to Bangladesh and India, where we had to change the way we were running the program because it was much hotter in where we were, and the places we were going to weren't as accessible, so we had to think about
it. Probably didn't have refrigeration.
There wasn't much. And so we had to think about how we were really using the vaccine rather than doing the mass vaccination. We started to do this thing called ring immunization. So we'd find an active case of smallpox, vaccinate everybody in that household, and then go 100 yards out from there and vaccinate everybody in that area, and then another
just
ring.
Just in your concentric circles.
Right, so that anybody that had contact with that one active case would be vaccinated. And so if you could find that active case and vaccinate everybody around, that virus had no place to go, and it finally died out.
And we're looking at here a mosquito trap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is far removed from what we think of as a scientist in their lab coat sitting there staring into
well, this
microscopes
area is
all day.
This area is all about what CDC has developed for other people to use. So fluorescent antibodies was something that was developed in the mid-50s, and then NIOSH also developed this air tester that you can wear and attach to workers so that they can test the air to see if the air that they're breathing in is safe. And this mosquito trap is really designed to trap live mosquitoes in the field. And this was developed by two scientists here at CDC. It used to be that you had to bring in this other trap that was about 35 pounds. They wanted something that was lighter because they're going further afield and it's heavier. And this was much lighter. You look over here on the AIDS wall. When this came out in the early 1980s, we weren't quite sure what it was, how it was transmitted. So we were trying to figure out how do we protect people from this when we don't even know really how it's infecting people. So there's these little bubbles on the wall, and I try to tell people how this is kind of how CDC works. We find the science behind it. What's the causative agent? What is causing it? And then we try to tell people all about what it is that's causing it. And then the last bubble is how can we prevent it from infecting people or how we can prevent from getting it. So it's the science. It's communication and then the prevention.
And sometimes it's a very urgent thing because I was alive. I was maybe 10 years old when AIDS virus first started hanging everybody. And there was a lot of medical professionals who didn't want to treat AIDS patients because
There was a lot of social stigma to it as well. And then also how it emerged came out of a group of people that weren't as accepted as they are today.
The homosexual community.
Right, exactly. So that community wasn't as accepted as they are now. And that was a stigma there. And then it started infecting other groups. There's a really interesting poster over here that kind of shows you what I mean, how people were looking at AIDS. It starts off and it says only gay men get AIDS. And then it goes down, only gay men and Haitians get AIDS. And then you have only gay men, Haitians, and drug users. And then only gay men, Haitians, drug users, blood recipients get AIDS. And it goes on and on and on.
And keep adding and adding.
Adding all these other populations that... And we found out that anybody can get AIDS.
Yeah.
It's a bloodborne disease, so...
In light of all this history that we're surrounded by, what must be heartbreaking for people at the CDC, which is that measles has been making a small comeback in the United States because of the lack of vaccinations. So I'm staring at this banner that says immunization campaigns, and the headlines show that, you know, we're in some ways losing a little ground.
Right. That's what another... part of the behavior that you can't control that. That's a person's own rights to their health. So they have a right to their own health. So they don't want to immunize their children. That's fine. There's nothing we can do about it. We can only suggest and recommend and say, we think this is a very good idea that you immunize your children. There's no health cost to it other than to immunize your children so that they're safer.
Thanks to CDC Historic Collections Manager Mary Hilpertshauser for the tour through public health history. We will be back at CDC headquarters in Atlanta tomorrow for a special live broadcast. We'll talk with the current director and other experts on how work that's done at the CDC affects everyone, even how public health is depicted in pop culture. So what do you want to know about the CDC? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Linda Chen, and Taylor Gant. Our interns are Jenna Stafford and Olivia Reingold. Lindsay Foster Thomas is our senior producer. Our engineers are Ryan Thomas and Jacob Boki. Tanya Ott is our vice president of radio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.